Well, I mean, that's part of why I have the 29 novels in Royal Road. I just kept getting excited, jumping the gun without any editing. Yeah, because they're not like huge novels, but well, for anyone out there, I took like the hard road to writing. I didn't get the one hit wonder. I got more like the I have 50 unwritten novels in my started and not finished in my computer. And yeah, and then I happened to hit that novel that worked and resonated with me.
This is the Crit RPG Podcast, your one-stop shop for everything Lit RPG, Progression Fantasy, and Royal Road.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Crit RPG Podcast, the only podcast that now can also be called the Cridge RPG Podcast. Okay, that didn't land well, but hi and welcome to the show. With today's Think Twice, you might know him as the author of Mark of the Cridgic.
Yep.
I hope I pronounced that correctly. And also as the author of many, many very helpful posts on Reddit about publishing and other cool stuff.
Thanks. I'm doing well. Having fun talking to you.
Yeah. So, yeah, we've already talked about, well, your writing schedule, actually. We talked about dopamine. I gave a little little lecture on dopamine.
And meth. Yeah, don't forget the meth.
And meth, yes. And we talked about the Door of Depression. So that's all in the Patreon content. So if you want to check that out, go and check it out, please. Thank you. But now we are going to actually delve into the book. Hey, tell us about the book or about any book you're writing or that you're excited about right now. Or excited
sure.
About.
Well, actually, all right. Well, with the book, funnily enough, I have a copy here. And that's it's mirrored, but it's not because I was coming here on the podcast. Yeah,
it works for me. Yeah,
Yeah. Well, it's because I was writing book 5, and I only finished it about a week ago, and so I have all the books here because I want to go through them and be like, did I miss anything, like loose plot threads and all that? And the answer is yes, I did.
Oh God, I feel you. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I fixed them, though. It took 215,000 words, so my biggest book so far, but I fixed it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You had to take a big swing for that.
Yeah. Well, I thought I'd be done a couple of months ago, at least a month ago, and then it just kept growing, and I was like, oh, no. Yeah. But no, it turned out well.
Yeah. I wish it wasn't as relatable.
I'll tell you what, I think the actual deadline hit and I was still on the final, not the final battle, like the pre-preparation part before the final battle. And in 2 days, I wrote 37,000 words. I think that was, yeah, it was only about 7 days ago or so to finish that book.
as the not quite as young kids say these days, Monka W. Like that is a lot of words.
I think I'm too old for that. Either that or I was just never cool. Both are equally possible.
Yeah. I mean, and you all did that, like, before breakfast. Because No, wait. Before
No, that one wasn't before breakfast. Yeah. I wrote 23,000 words. Like, I sat down. I was like, I'm going to do this. And then my friend came over at, like, 7 a.m. I'm like, I could still do this. I'll just write while they're over here. That was 23 hours, like with breaks, of course, but it was 23 hours. The reason I stopped is because I fell asleep at my computer. I fell asleep for like a minute. I woke up. I'm like, I can't do this. I'll do the rest tomorrow. And the next day I was, wow, it was tough, but I did.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I did the rest of it that day.
Yeah. Staring at your computer screen fills you with motivation, determination. Okay, I got that.
Yeah.
Oh, man. It's...
Well, the deadline did. I was like, the deadline was on that day. I was still a day late with it, but yeah.
Okay, I mean, we still haven't talked about what the book's actually about, but I have to ask a very important question here. So you don't revise or rewrite. You finish the book and then you ship it off to the publisher and go like, good luck with it.
Sort of. I do rewrite. So I have rewritten this one. They came back with the edits. I then spent, I think, well, okay, I gotta tell you that this isn't how the normal week looks like. It's a release kind of, you know, deadline week, I spent the next 15 hours, I think it was a couple of days ago, running it through Grammarly and running it through GDocs, like the spelling program there, because it's better than Word. Mm-hmm. Now, what happens is I had to run it chapter by chapter for Grammarly and chapter by chapter for, or not chapter by chapter, but like I go through it bit by bit with GDocs. And so I rewrite it as I go through there, because the actual book took a while. I was still rewriting different sections. Like I go back at the beginning of the day, rewrite the sections, come back, start writing the actual book again. And that's generally how it works, especially, so if I've got more time. Yep, you look confused. Did I confuse you there?
So, yes, a little bit. So you go for it. Say you're writing chapter 10.
Yep.
At the start of the day, you go back and edit or rewrite chapter 1, and then you go back to chapter 10?
Pretty much. It's, okay. Yeah. So if I can, I put a month between them. So I've got another series called The Root of All Evil, and I'm going back to book 2, which I'm 150,000 words into, and I'm going back to chapter 1. Well, I'm on chapter 6 now, and I'm rewriting them. Because I can only rewrite them once I've got the end of the book done, because then I just go back and add foreshadowing and stuff.
Okay. So your rewrites are actual rewrites, not just revisions. So you go to the end of the book and you're like, well, that didn't work out as I planned. And then you kind of like go through there with a cheese grater and.
Yeah, exactly. Right. It ties up some loose ends, especially because with the web serialization format, you don't get to go back that much, if that makes sense. Because you're posting day by day, week by week. But with Mark of the Krijic book 5, because I was on deadline and still reaching it, I had to do the revisions during, and I had to do them after when I got the edits back. Yeah.
So that sounds extremely painful.
I mean, it was for that time, but I don't mind it as well. So it all adds to the word count, which is what I'm aiming towards here. So, well, I mentioned to you before, so before we're on here, my goal was 1 million words, but kind of like the reach for the star goal for the year is 2 million words. So, you know, why not go double? See if you hit the moon instead of the star, sort of thing, right? And so editing and revising, they actually do add a lot of words. I'm not the kind of guy that ends up cutting out words. I actually go too minimal. I lose all sentence description, like scene description, setting, all that kind of stuff. And so when I go back and revise, I add a lot of words. It's like 300 to 600 words a chapter or something.
I feel like I can relate to that because I don't explain too much. And that leaves people very confused. And maybe because I am confused when I'm writing it. So I actually add like entire chapters.
Right. Yeah, see?
Like, oh, shit, I didn't explain that. Mm-hmm. Okay, I got that. Okay.
Yeah.
But now, this is what we're all here for. Tell us what are, well, basically both series about. So, whichever you like.
Sure. Well, with Mark of the Krijic. All right. So, it's not too out there, hopefully, if you guys have read manga or not. But if you haven't, then it's about a person that that dies and reincarnates in a fantasy world as a baby. Now, my second series, The Root of All Evil, took a little bit of a different path. It's about a guy, and he dies. And then he reincarnates into a fantasy world as a baby. So as you can see, very different plots. You know, I'm pretty sure. Like,
that is like going from one to the other. That is like whiplash.
I know, right? So with Mark of the Krijic. All right, so Mark of the Krijic, they actually are two very different stories. So with Mark of the Krijic, it follows Andros Silva. So that's the main character's name. He's named after the Red Ranger in Power Rangers in Space. And just because I'm like, you know, I want to pay homage to that character.
I mean, Jake from Primal Hunter is named after Jake DeBralta from... Brooklyn 101. So,
oh, that's pretty cool. Yeah, exactly. and what happens what happens is he, so obviously he dies, reincarnates, all that jazz, but he actually stays as a baby the entire book one. So, ends up as a toddler around 3 years old toward the end of the book. Now, he's been marked by this eldritch being that he sees that nobody else can see because only babies see it. Now, that part is a bit brutal, but essentially the way you gain your system in the world is you undergo a trial. You see this eldritch being, and if you survive, you do not die. Most of the babies don't make it. But we don't deep dive into that, but it is a big theme in the story where the world is essentially a very dangerous one to live in, right? Even the system require, yeah. Yep.
How do they manage population growth?
Right. So the good thing is humans are pretty resilient once you get the system, right? The issue is that before then, when you're a baby, I believe I said it at 6 months is when, 6 months or 1 year exactly is when the actual event happens. So the only thing is,
you're saying that's the critical time?
It is, because the being he sees is the Krijik. And that's the issue with reincarnators. So an ordinary baby doesn't have too much of a reaction to an eldritch being. Yep. The Krijik notices that this baby is acting weird. And just that noticing, so it's an eldritch being, so it doesn't actually talk to him. It doesn't acknowledge him too much or anything like that. It simply notices him. And that bestows him with its mark. Now, the mark is kind of a chosen one mark. We are all familiar with them. A god marks you, you get their powers. Mm-hmm. The difference is, in this world, there are 7 divines. The Krijik is one of them. Mm-hmm. And there are 7 marks. And they are constantly recycling between people. So you've got the first person with their mark, for example, of the Krijik. When they die, another baby inherits it. But because the main character came in here, it's the first time ever that somebody didn't die, but somebody else still inherited the mark. So there's 2 marks of the Krijik in the world. Okay. He's essentially a religious figure when the other religious figure is still alive. And
like that, a Pope.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, it's more like Jesus. Because people think that they are the divines themselves. Yeah. And they're not necessarily bad in that assumption. So Andros's cheat skill that he can't really use, but he has a cheat skill in that he wields divine mana. So him and the 7 people, they are the only ones that can do that, the marked ones, with one exception of a clan. And anybody else who tries, they kind of pop, you know, explode. Yeah. And I'm not going to lie, there's a lot of downsides to the mark. There's a lot of upsides. There's a lot of downsides too. So every time it activates, it gives him 50 mana and a chance to earn some intelligence stats, right? So awesome. He also feels incredible pain, and that pain increases as the mark gets used more because it keeps leveling up, and the only thing that changes is that it causes him more pain.
What a benefit.
Yeah, and so what happens is he wants to learn how to survive, but the whole first book is about him not telling the church because marked ones have a couple of non-benefits as well, politically speaking. So if you're a marked one and there's another marked one around, someone's going to want to lock you up, or they might capture you, or they might do whatever. Like the church might not accept that there's a second divine figure just walking around. And the other thing is that the mark actually kills people at the age of 25. Yeah, they undergo something called an ascension. So book 5, The Ascension, is all about an ascension. And what that does is it fills the marked one with a lot of divine mana in one go over the course of a day. And historically, for the past 1,000 years, every single marked one has exploded. Like, no matter what they've tried. And they've tried some crazy stuff. And so that's what the main character has to kind of watch out for, because his time is coming up and he needs to figure out a way to both survive that and escape the clutches of the church at the same time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cool.
So you're spanning 25 years in 5 books. That means you're doing time jumps.
Good question. I didn't. So in 5 books, he is 5 years old. So he is not a very old person. The ascension happening in book 5 is actually somebody else's ascension, but I won't give any spoilers. That's great. Yeah. So what happens is, I've had trouble with the time skips.
Okay. Well, you didn't have trouble with the time skips, you said?
I did. A lot of trouble. I can't do time skips.
You either have to establish them very early that you're doing them, or don't do them at all. There's a wonderful author called Rebecca Gablé.
Okay.
And she is a German professor of history, of English and like medieval history. And she wrote amazing books about medieval England and medieval Germany. She also wrote the novel for Settlers of Catan, which is really good.
Oh, nice.
I can recommend them. And what I most recommend them for is that they're the Smile, Fortuna's Smile, I think is the first one. And it's very long for a trad book, and has very interesting character progression, in even in lit RPG sense, because it goes from outcast because the previous king declared his father an outlaw.
Yep.
All the way up to the right hand of the prince, right? Mm. So he kind of like goes through that thing and. Gablé always writes these books about people who are very close to kings or queens or something like that, because then you can see the history and have that action going on, but you can also like have personal development that is not, you know, the king or the queen. And I thought this is very interesting, and I want to write something like that at some point. But she does time skips very well, right?
Okay.
Because she really nails down on what is important here. So she skips all the training. She skips all the weird fumbling, and when she mentions something as not being, it is often just fluff. And you know what the most important things are. And it's a very cool skill. And I have no idea how exactly she does it, but it's a good book to read if you want to find out.
I get you. So it's something like, let's say, on the end of a chapter, the main character is facing a trainer, and the trainer says, "Let's begin." And then you go to the next chapter and it says 5 months later. And it shows like the next battle.
Like that.
Yeah.
A little bit like that. So she does it really well. Like she ends chapters on almost like a loose thread. Hmm. Right? So you have like a thread waving in the mist, I guess. And then there's another thread like a couple of times later. And for example, she has the main character. Okay, cool. I will... In another book, I will start my own merchant empire. That's all good. I will do that. And now let's do something else for now, right? So it's like straight cut.
Yeah. Okay.
And then in the next one, he's like, it's not like 5 months later, but it is. I don't quite know how she does it. I'll have to read it again because it's really, really good.
Yeah.
It's
cool. It's a skill.
Okay, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, for Mark of the Critic, on the cinnamon bun to dungeon crawler Carl scale, where are you at?
Oh, definitely in the middle. So, the setting for the first book and parts of the other books is horror, but it's more eldritch, ethereal horror, where there's the intangibility of what you can do against these giant monstrosities that appear to be watching the world, right? Mm-hmm. But the main character himself, so I wanted to write a guy, right? All my main characters before then have been females. And my issue with male characters is that I kept self-inserting every single time. So I did a different strategy. I wrote an ordinary guy going into a fantasy world. And that was my main issue. He was an ordinary guy. So he that and he was a baby. It was very hard to make it action filled because there is this, you know, baby who's an ordinary guy and ordinary people. I have a big issue where I like reasons behind why people become successful or not. Mm-hmm. And I want their personality to carry through from the beginning of their time on Earth to the fantasy world. And so Andros is this really wise, common sense male who does all the right things. And that makes for a terrible action novel. So it doesn't turn out quite like Dungeon Crawler Carl, where the earth is flattened in the first chapter and he's shouting at the cat to go into his arms, and then they have to go underground. That sort of stuff, right? Mm-hmm. You know, spoilers for the first chapter of Thundercrawler, Kyle. It's more of a sit back, explore the magic of the world while there are these big looming threats creating tension throughout the entirety of the novel, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of it is figuring out how to, first of all, stop his mind from degrading, because every time he remembers the Krijic, because it's just there in his memories, he starts going mad, right? Losing big amounts of time. I think at some point, so he tried to tell his dad, one of my favorite scenes to write, he tries to tell his dad that there's something out there because he can't speak or think of the divine without going mad. So he tries to push himself, and he doesn't notice anything wrong. But he wakes up 2 hours later, and his dad's, you know, stopping him, and he's drawn the Krijic in like a whole bunch of paintings just all over the room, sort of thing. Cool. That kind of stuff, right? And then you've got the looming threat of the church and anyone else who might discover who he is. And to counteract that, he meets William and Jeriel. So William is a super intelligent baby, and Jeriel is a super intelligent child, because the people who interact with babies, I wanted them to be of equal ages, right? Or at least similar. And so that's where a lot of the flow comes from. In other words, meeting these new characters, figuring out how to escape insanity, figuring out how to escape any sort of imprisonment or death, those sorts of things. They lead the tension of the novel, and it turns out to be much more of a thriller, you know, psychological thriller sort of thing, but not really. I don't know how to describe it. There's just no, it's not a action novel at that point. It's more of a tense, nicely paced world building novel where the main character is trying to solve these mysteries, essentially, of what's happening.
I think, yeah, a mystery thriller novel, that is perfectly fine, right? I think the only genres that really don't do well in as lit RPG are you can do action, obviously, right?
Yeah,
it's your Jack Reacher novels or military fantasy, really easy, because guy goes in, kills a lot of shit, evil guy is dead, great. Right? Not bashing on it, it's not easy to write necessarily, still lots of skill required, but the plot is very straightforward. Mystery also works, I think, to a lesser degree, because you have to kind of like fill the gaps and kind of figure out how the system works. You know, if not killing things all the time. Same thing for kingdom building, for example, which is basically dungeon core novels are kingdom builders.
Yeah.
Right. In a way, or city builders or something like that, which are pretty cool. Cozy works too, because you explicitly say like, no, there won't be any growth. We're just going to hang out here. Come chill.
Yeah.
But what doesn't work are the literary stuff. You can't write an old man and the sea lit RPG. Right? Because it's literally just character versus himself or herself. And I think as long as there's some sort of external motivation, you won't have that. That sounds arrogant. I don't mean to say that. But... You will be able to write a good lit RPG as long as there is external motivation.
Yeah, and so, it's a good point. So with internal motivators, emotions, self-conflict, personal drama from the past, they're tougher in our genre not necessarily to write and integrate with lit RPG. That part shouldn't be too difficult. It would be finding the audience for it that would be a lot more difficult. So,
yeah.
it just happens to be a thing in the genre where the people, like the readers, usually follow specific niches, tropes, genres, etc., or ways of doing things, essentially, that don't necessarily coincide with that, and hardcore romance generally.
That's harem.
No, not that kind of... No, I wouldn't call harems romance most times. I meant more like a genuine romantic relationship where the partners are equal and building up over time, you know, dating, right? It can happen and has happened pretty well, but usually it's not the direct focus of the novel. At least not in... Yeah. Like, it's harder to find an audience for those kinds of things, at least in the lit RPG space.
So the will they, won't they thing. I got you. So I should have said, like, it's not motivation, because even if there's an external threat, you have to be self-motivated, right? You can be like, well, aliens invaded, systems here, better go die. You have to be internally motivated. It is, there's this Greek word called agon, which describes clash or struggle. And it's the core concept of every story, right? Someone wants something, another thing or person doesn't want that thing to happen, and so you clash. And then the person who will survive and why. So that's where the word protagonist and antagonist come from, actually. And you have to have an external antagonizing force that makes it easy. Like, the antagonizing force cannot be internal. Like, there's nothing that people in the RPG space, I will say, hate in quotation marks here, hate more than a character who fucks himself over, and that's the plot.
Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. And characters that, I don't know, lose agency for whatever reason in genuine ways. So, mind control, those kinds of things.
Getting crippled.
Yeah, that too. Yeah.
I mean,
the crippled one is a bit different. So, it depends on how they're crippled and why. So, I found a lot of novels are accepting of a main character is crippled in one way, as long as they gain something of equal or better return in a different way. And then later, uncrippled. So a main character who can't walk but gains the ability to learn every single skill not involving their legs, for example. So they might be able to learn magic at an increased pace or something like that. That's the core concept of a new rebirth kind of novel like my own one, because as a baby, he can't walk. But he can focus on magic and learning magic because he's got all this time to himself where he can't walk, right? Those kinds of trade-offs, they happen frequently and they work, right? Even in the most minor ways. So He Who Fights With Monsters, this, you know, small lit RPG novel you may have heard of. He starts with a small disadvantage of no clothes right from the first chapter, right? That's his smaller motivation to gain clothes. But that's what people start with. They start with a small or big obstacle. And the actual lead up to solving that obstacle is going to get even bigger rewards. That's what people know is going to happen. So we know when he gets clothes, well, it's set out from the outright that he's going to get clothes by completing quests. And so the reader knows, hey, he's got this obstacle, but if he solves it, he's not only going to have clothes, he's going to have, you know, even more than clothes. He's going to have a system. He's going to have knowledge of how to use the system. He's going to be empowered by the system.
He's going to have clothes with witty banter on them.
Exactly.
That is actually very, very succinct. Very good analysis of that. Yeah, I like that a lot.
Yeah, these kinds of things. I remember, so the other thing that's really common, I was studying Dungeon Crawl with Carl just, I read it ages ago, but I was restudying it again for another post on Reddit. The first thing to get to be lost by Carl in the first four or five pages is actually his common sense. Because so all the shelters in the world get destroyed. They get crushed into the ground, right? That's a reversal of common sense. It's not necessarily super obvious, but it's there because common sense would dictate that you're safe inside a shelter that's made by humans. Here we have the opposite. The only thing's not to fall trees and some bikes and stuff. So in other words, everything man-made is no longer safe. The common sense is reversed. And the reader is given a promise that there's a new world because, you know, he gets contacted by the aliens or whatever, and they tell them what's happening and everyone's got to go underground. You know that this new common sense, adapting to the knowledge that there is an apocalypse happening and everyone's just died, is going to make Carl even better in this new world. these are the small and big obstacles. They're not necessarily super tangible or super obvious at first, but they're the ones that appear in the first chapters, for example, that you know the main character will overcome and become better for. My own novel has the pretty obvious one. The main character dies. And, you know, by accepting that he's dead, he will then become even stronger than he was before, right? With a system in a new fantasy world to explore. Mm-hmm. It's the basic premise that there is an obstacle to overcome, and it's not necessarily one that's too difficult for the reader to process, because it's not meant to be. It's not meant to be an obstacle where you stop and the whole novel just pauses. It's an obstacle that it's huge, but not so huge that the main character can't get over it in a few pages.
Mm-hmm. Death.
Well, yeah.
So, but I think that's a good point. Isekai and RPG go so well together because it's both a promise of a reset.
Mm-hmm.
And also a promise that the main character can overcome a lot of stuff that is usually very bad.
yeah.
Right. So I think that's a very good point. I like that. Mm-hmm. When you're saying, like, so you're saying common sense, I kind of thought about that a little bit more. And I was kind of struggling with that term mm-hmm. for a while. But I think it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing Carl actually loses is his girlfriend.
Yes.
Right. So first the girlfriend, then the possibility of safety and shelter.
Mm-hmm.
And then a lot of other stuff because it's Dungeon Crawler Carl. But yeah.
Well, that's the thing. So the obstacle itself also serves as sort of a severing for the prior attachments to whatever life they used to hold.
Mm.
I mean, that's the whole hero's journey, a new world approach, like a new world is here to explore, and you don't want anything holding you back. So Mark of the Krijic, the main character dies. Mm. That's a pretty big severing. Dungeon Crawler Carl, like you said, girlfriend's gone. The world is gone. It's a big severing as well. And again, he fights with monsters. Well, he loses his clothes and he goes to another world. So he has no remnants of what's used to be his, except for himself.
And he loses his amazing job as a stationery salesman. God, that must have sucked. So you're saying it's horror that you're writing, so Mark of the Critic,
but it was for the first book. Yeah.
Okay. But then it kind of like gets better. Better as in like
sure.
not as horrible. You know what I mean.
Yeah, no, I get you. It gets not as horrible. So Mark of the Krijic was written under pretty unique circumstances, is how I describe them. But the core premise was a completely different novel. It wasn't a lit RPG. It was a horror novel. Because back when I was like 13 years old, I was in Chile and I was like, oh, I want to write a horror novel. And we were passing some mountains, and I was imagining, you know, what would it be like if some guy went up to the mountains, found an isolated village, but they all have their own rituals worshipping this creature called the Krijic. Now, in that novel, the Krijic was like this man-bird hybrid with wings that came at night and snatched up people. It was all this sort of stuff, like a classic horror stuff. And it was spelled with two I's, C-R-I-I-J-I-K. So what I did was I kept the horror theme and I kind of scrapped the extra I. and then instead, it was actually called Cry of the Krijic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why in the first chapter, when he is confronting the Eldritch Horror, it cracks open the sun and breaks the entire planet from the shockwaves, you know, as you do. That's because it was still at the time called Cry of the Krijic. That's what its cry did. It destroyed the entire planet. Then I wrote that and he got the mark. And I was like, wait, Mark of the Krijic sounds so much more cooler. And then I started posting it. And I think about half a book later, I realized Mark of the Fool existed. So that was awkward. but yeah, no, that's how the name came about. Because the cry wasn't as important as the mark. At that first chapter point. So I switched because the mark drives everything in the story. I love the name of my novel because the Mark of the Krijic literally derails every single destiny or fate that Andros would have had in this new world. Book five elaborates on that a bit more, but essentially his path was broken because this one divine being noticed him for a single instance of time. That's all he had to do. Yeah. And so,
very much like Immortan Joe. If he notices you, your life will change forever.
Yeah, exactly, right? And so the actual book, though, well, like I said, it was written under... So he's a baby for a reason. That reason is because I happened to be crippled at the time. Not like the greatest time in life. Mm-hmm. But we don't quite know what caused it. Like, it's some sort of syndrome. So I had a whole bunch of different things. Reactive arthritis and a few other things. Yada yada, boring stuff. Mm-hmm. But while I was learning to dictate, because I couldn't use my arms and legs, that's when I wrote Mark of the Krijic, while I was dictating. And because I was dictating and because I couldn't use my arms and legs, that's why he stays a baby, because that's what I happened to know at the time, if that makes sense. I was writing what I knew. And I had a few goals when I was writing it, so male MC, action-oriented, all those sorts of things. First person too, because I wanted to learn how to write first person. And it turned out popular. Like, that was the first time, because you can't really do anything else if you're just lying in a bed, unable to move. And so I had a lot of time to dedicate to actually writing fun stuff. I wrote like 3 books in like 3 months or something. And so that's why he is a baby. And it was fun. It went well. And I now make my living off writing it.
Which is pretty cool. I mean, I'm just looking at it right now. It's has an amazing favorites to followers ratio, by the way.
Oh, really? So, I haven't looked at the...
25% of all followers are favorite.
Nice. Yeah. I think most of it's been taken off Royal Road now. It's pretty much all on Amazon. That was a decision I did on purpose, though, due to like Royal Road toxicity. I've got like an update post and all that there. It explains the whole thing, but basically I was like, honestly, can't really handle it right now. Well, this was more like a year and 2 months ago or so, and I was like, well, better off going fully to Amazon, because if I'm giving a novel for free, but then I've got a whole bunch of people coming to me on Discord, Reddit, and other places messaging me, telling me how the book is bad or how they'd improve it, it's not really worth it, because they all come from Royal Road. I don't know. I had a very vocal fan base compared to the other people, and they all wanted sort of dungeon crawler Carl levels of murder, hobo kind of thing. Not exactly dungeon crawler Carl, but like they wanted that sort of stuff. But for some reason, they wanted a lot more with my novel. And like I said, my novel is in between, and that's likely why I got the best of both worlds in terms of readers. I got those who were okay with the slice of life. Not goody two-shoes, but not murderous main character. And those that really wanted the extremes for the other ends. So I was like, maybe not for all work.
I think that's like totally valid, right? Especially the point where he said, hey, I'll just take it off. Because, when you're getting that many messages, I don't know. Like, I always feel as though people don't message you if you don't care about your book. That's a lot of effort to go into. A lot of effort. Like, leaving a rating is like, okay, cool, whatever. Leaving a comment is like, okay, a bit more effort. But then going through all the hoops, like finding you in Discord, adding you in Discord, messaging you on Discord, that's a lot of effort to put into. Also, they loved your story. They just wanted it to be different.
Yeah. But you didn't still, shit, so. It still continues every now and then. So I know about 3 or 4 days ago, I got a message on Reddit, and it said, hey, I read your book up to about chapter 8, and if you want, I'll be able to go through why I didn't like it and why I dropped it and why I didn't continue it and what you can do to, you know, improve your writing. And I sent them that exact post. I'm like, hey, I posted this, you know, just the other day onto why I don't quite take, you know, feedback every now and then. But like, yeah, I don't know. So that person hadn't even read the full book and they were still sending the feedback. So it was kind of like, I guess it just happens to be that kind of, thing.
I was just like, that's perfectly fine, but can you please send me, like, what do you do for fun?
Football.
like football, like dancing or something, send me a video of that. I'll watch the first 8 minutes and then tell you how bad you are. And then we can just exchange notes. How about
yeah. So, like, yeah, like, it happens.
It's like, people are trying to be helpful, and I get that. But at some point, you kind of have to, like, think of how your words impact other people first.
Yeah, for sure.
It's a very important topic for me, so I think it's probably one of the only times where you
can... Well, it's absolutely... Yeah, it's absolutely important. There are a lot of people leaving Royal Road nowadays due to the toxicity, but it's not just that. So it's becoming harder for authors to justify taking the toxicity, because I'm sure every author would leave if they could, but a lot of them don't, because the more successful authors are the ones usually that get a lot of feedback. And in return for being successful, they also have large Patreons bring a lot of money, and so they can't just up and quit because they'd lose an entire source of income. Maybe their only source of income in some cases. Whereas other people find it a bit easier because now we're getting scrapers on Royal Road posting, any fiction that goes through RS and gets popular gets posted on Amazon, which is a huge issue. And so there's quite a few authors that say, is it worth it to go to Royal Road anymore? And the toxicity just adds to that, if that makes sense. But
my solution to that is I'll post my first drafts on Royal Road. I will not put the polished stuff on there.
That's the issue with the scraping. So the issue with the scraping isn't losing a few sales. It's actually the fact that they take your name and your book, and if it shares similarities, which it will, even if as a first draft, you simply can't post your book in there anymore because Amazon will reject it as a copy, and you'll lose any potential income.
You can take it down.
No, that sounds serious. Exactly. You can take it down. So there's like, if anyone out here wants to self-publish, that's still perfectly fine. Like, you can take down the plagiarism if you find it, but that's just the concern that people have that,
Oh no, I totally get it. Like, and the other thing is like, I love my commenters, every single one of them. But it takes a lot of effort to cultivate that community.
Mm.
Some people, Royal Road can be such a good place if you take the time to make it a good place. Your novel, if you're coming into a room into an apartment of someone, you get an impression of who they are, who their friends are, and what the sense of general conduct is that people have there, right? If you go into a frat house of, Alpha, Kappa, Gamma, or whatever, the people who are like fist bumping and like chest bumping and bro fisting or whatever, and there's someone in the corner doing like ass chugging, and they're like, okay, cool, this is how people act here, right? But then if you're going into some nerdy Magic the Gathering group that's actually just a bunch of friends, they're all quiet, they're reading a book, they're playing some magic, and they're all friendly with each other, that's different. So same thing with comment sections. If you only respond to the ones that leave good comments, you engage with them. You're like, not just like thanks, but actually engage with the people. People will see, okay, cool. Like, if I write a comment like this, I actually can interact with the author. I get heard. I actually also made the point to interact with some people who didn't write nice comments. I'm like, hey, thanks for reading so far. What is it that you would like to see here? It takes a lot of effort, because you have to keep yourself cool, right? All these people, they wouldn't have posted if they didn't want something. Some people really just want to get a rise out of you. And then if they can't answer the question of, hey, what would you have liked better? Then you just block them because I don't have time for that. But if they're like, hey, I didn't like this and this and I wanted it to be different, then you can ask them why. What would you have liked to have happened instead? And sometimes those people just really don't know what to say. You can learn to tell the difference pretty soon. But yeah, sorry. The point being, you can actually cultivate a very good environment, and I love the readers who read my book because they're all nice.
Yeah. And with me...
I'll see what happens as soon as I hit like 2,000 followers, but we'll see.
Yeah. So with me and a few others, it's a bit of a different situation. Cultivating the chat is simply too much effort. So as I mentioned with you, a lot of the people that I engaged with or that tried to engage with me, they did so through Discord, Reddit, those sorts of things. So they wouldn't see the chat in the first place, if that makes sense. Similarly, I don't know if you've talked about this with them, but some big authors like Zogarth, who writes Primal Hunter, they receive emails in terms, you know, just insulting them, those sorts of things. Those are the kinds of engagement that are, so I know that some people, so Sunrise CV, writer of System Universe, and I think Trader as well, I'm not sure, but a few different people, they don't check the comment sections anymore for Royal Road. It's just no reason to. Similarly, cultivating a chat room, I've only seen novels do it well when they're slice of life, happy kind of novels. So super supportive is probably the prime example of absolutely incredibly high user base giving positive comments. But even then, I'm not sure if the author checks Royal Road as opposed to Patreon, because Patreon is where most authors who are big would check the comments, because Royal Road is simply too toxic. And if you're big enough to cultivate your chats to be nice, well, you'd rather do that on Patreon because you'd be big enough to have a big Patreon chat or a Discord, those kinds of things.
Yeah. I don't have a Patreon for my book. I do have a Patreon for this podcast, though, so there you go. Yeah, I don't have a Patreon for my book. I tried it out. It didn't get a huge resonance. I made a couple of $100. It was nice, but in the end, it wasn't really worth it for me.
Yeah.
Also, I made a pricing mistake. I priced the chapters too high, and my novel isn't really all that suited for Patreon. Yeah, it doesn't start out very cliffhangery, you know.
Yeah.
Cool. But anyway, I see your point. I see the point of you would rather do this on Patreon because people actually, you know, pay to be there.
They would rather do it on Patreon. I stopped my Patreon too. I was just like, it's not worth the effort. I think I was getting, I don't know what it was in US dollars, but for me, it was about $2,000 a month. And then I was like, because I had that period of burning out for several months in a row.
Yeah.
Most of that was coming from the pressure of having to update constantly. I'm more of an arm's length writer, but also I am more of a non-constant writer. I prefer to be able to write several chapters or books on my own and then go back and revise them. And that, the constant posting just wasn't allowing me to do that. The negativity was just a cherry on top kind of thing.
I really want to ask you about your process, but we'll do that after the show.
Sure.
So I want to move on to the next question here. So we talked about Mark of the Critic and how that's, you know, somewhere in the middle between Cinnamon Bun and Dungeon Crawler Carl on the horror scale. You know, it changes later on. So I'm guessing Root of All Evil is very cozy.
No. Well, it's a lot less horror. It's a lot more action. So my goal for The Root of All Evil was actually pretty simple. I wanted the character to be fully fleshed out and have a character arc. I wanted him to be fast-paced and action-y, so he couldn't just stay as a baby the entire time. And I wanted the world to be a little bit more grounded because, Andros Silva in Mark of the Critic, he is strong from the beginning. He doesn't know it, and he works in different ways, but he is strong. He is above the system simply by being one of the Divine's Chosen. That was a big issue for me. 5 books later, he's level 1.
Well, it's a new ad. If you're interested in having your story shouted out on this podcast, please reach out to me under critrpg.podcast@gmail.com. For now, I just finished the first book in my own series, Torchbearer. If you like a slow burn story about weak to OP main characters, mixing magic and technology and numbers going up, you might also enjoy this one. You can find the link to my link tree down below. And that's all for now. Thank you very much for listening and or watching, and let's get on with the show.
So he has a lot of skill abilities. He has a lot of skills. He uses all the magic and everything. But I wanted the main character of The Root of All Evil to be the kind of person who levels up a lot, who has a plethora of different abilities, and who actually focuses on crafting as well as a side hobby, which Andros does, but doesn't do as much because, again, he's above everything. Yeah, and so the root of all evil takes place in the same world. There's some differences, which are spoilers, but you'd be able to work them out pretty quickly by reading both novels. But basically, it's a completely separate novel set in the same sort of world. That main character, he's an action-oriented guy. He had to be in order to create a character that would be able to be thrown into a fantasy world and survive, right?
Yeah.
So his name is Alexander Claudius. But his actual name that he gives you in the novel is Dollar. Because, well, there's a backstory towards it, but his name is Dollar. That's the whole root of all evil. Money. Mm-hmm. Dollar.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Right. Nice. Yeah. And so Dollar, he starts off a bit differently. He's one of those children who was neglected by his parents who were abusive. They often kicked him out of the house because they made him pay for his bed and breakfast. And if he couldn't pay them, well, he lived outside for that day. You know, that kind of stuff, right? Until his grandma swoops into his life, takes him under her wing, and, well, she doesn't beat him, but she, you know, forces a good work ethic into him, shows him how to rise above his, you know, bad circumstances. And once he's done that, he realizes that he doesn't have any happiness because he never found the time to make any friends or have genuine connections, anything like that. He did make a lot of money, but even then people treat him badly just because he's made a lot of money, never take into account the person that he is with those original circumstances. And then he dies. So good for him because he can go into a new world where he is incredibly poor, down in his luck. His family are trying to kill him, and they even send a divine being to go and assassinate him. But because he is the kind of guy who rises above everything else to the point where he went from zero money to a lot of money, or even went from zero influence to a lot of influence, he's the kind of guy who, no matter what, no matter who he's facing, whether it's his family members that are magical, whether it's a divine being, etc., he will overcome them through sheer willpower and strategy and cunning. Now, that with the root of all evil is the main thing that's really fun to write. But that's also why it's not a horror, because in the face of this main character, there is nothing that horrifies him. He'll overcome it all through sheer willpower. Now, I did have to do a few caveats. So he meets another divine. So not the Krijic, he meets Enth, the divine of symbols, and that's the divine sent to kill him. He doesn't encounter the real Enth, so he encounters sort of like a splinter of the being, so he doesn't go mad. That is why... So that was a big difference between him and Andros. Andros encountered the original divine, who really doesn't care about whether it's seen or not, and so that's why he saw its main body. Or no, he saw a splinter as well, but it was more of a splinter that's like, hey, I don't care. I'm destroying the world. I'm not going to care if you go mad seeing me, right? Whereas Enth was a lot more like, I want to learn from you right now. So I want something from you. I'm going to make sure you don't go mad when you see me, kind of thing. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. And so he survives the encounter and he doesn't die, which is great. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Okay. Actually, talking about wanting to know something from you so I don't kill you, so that it won't get you mad. You've written a lot of stuff, like 29 fictions on Railroad alone.
Ah, yeah, I have, yep.
Mm-hmm. What's the best advice you've ever gotten as an author?
Gosh, it's not really a piece of advice. I honestly, I don't even remember who told me if I read it from a blog. I have the worst piece of advice and the best piece of advice. The best piece is just knowing that. So someone told me the first 1,000,000 words you write are going to be crap. It's not really advice, you know, go and write 1,000,000 words. But I actually went back and counted after Mark of the Krijic did really well when I didn't expect it to. And across those 29 fictions and the many other fictions I've written, including one full 80K word manuscript that's still unedited in my computer, I had written exactly a million words or so. Like, obviously not exactly, but like give or take a few words. And then I popped off. So it resonated with me. I thought, okay, wow, that piece of advice was actually right. I didn't realize until after I took it, but it was right.
You would be surprised how many authors say like, yeah, it's like I've written like 3 books or 4 books and then I was really good. And it's always, always the million word mark.
Yeah. And that's the thing. So the worst piece of advice, alternatively, was edit your own novel because, and then leave a few mistakes so that the editors feel like they have a job to do. It was this blog I was just reading because I read a lot of blogs and all that every now and then. And man, that piece of advice, I could tell that guy had never written a novel before. I have like 4,000 mistakes per novel if I'm lucky. And those are just like the surface level mistakes until you go into the actual proofreading and stuff. But his advice was more like, okay, so we're really good and we're authors, so we're awesome. We don't make mistakes. Just get yourself to the level where you don't have to make mistakes and then, you know, you'll be fine. And that's not realistic. So it's aiming for perfection kind of mindset, but with a bit of a condescending tone to it. I didn't like that. But it's also unrealistic. I hope no one takes that advice or take this advice. You don't need to be perfect to be a published author. That is exactly what other people have their jobs there for, editors and all that, to help you. It is an issue if you don't get editors and all that, because there's still more than likely to be a lot of mistakes. But yeah, it's a big issue. So you still got to edit, but you can't aim for perfection or you might self-destruct. There are people that go out there every single day, and because they re-edit and rewrite the first chapters so much, they never complete a book. They never get past it. Yeah.
I wish I knew def editing or had a def editor, you know? So I don't think the perfection ideal is a thing. Books are, and stories in general, or any product, gets better if more people work on it. That's right, because it gets a perspective of more people. It's a simple truth. You may, of course, luck out and write something that resonates with a lot of people on the first go, but chances are, if you have an editor, he will make it better. So I still struggle with not being too much of a perfectionist, but I can definitely see where you're coming from with that. It's a bit tough. Yeah. I think we can still talk about that, or we should be talking about that. We're talking about the rewriting later on, but yeah, editors, we need them.
Well, I mean, that's part of why I have the 29 novels in Royal Road. I just kept getting excited, jumping the gun without any editing. Cause they're not like huge novels, but well, for anyone out there, I took like the hard road to writing. I didn't get the one hit wonder. I got more like the I have 50 unwritten novels in my started and not finished in my computer, and and then I happened to hit that novel that worked and resonated with me. And like you said, so you wanted to know dev editing, right? I do the same thing. I have, just like you have behind you, you've got the editing books and all that. I have my own shelf section with editing books, grammar books, all those sorts of things, because I want to improve my craft, but also because I enjoy that stuff, like learning how to do better and how to improve myself in different ways. Improvement is one of my hobbies, which is super lame to say, but I love it. Like, just figuring out different methods on how to improve in different areas is my jam. And that's part of why the Reddit posts that I do, they're all based around improvement. Because they're the notes, for the most part, they're the notes that I make as I'm editing, and then I just edit them more to make them legible and put them on Reddit, if that makes sense. Yeah.
Makes sense, yeah. I wish I could take notes. I'm so bad at taking notes. I just write them down, and then my mind goes off on a tangent. I'm like, what did I even... Sometimes it happens in a paragraph. I'm writing a paragraph, and it starts at A and it ends on Z. I'm like, what? Wow. How did I get here? So, yeah. Okay. Again, editors, We need that. yeah. So, you were talking about, you know, improving, trying to improve, and learning how to improve. What's the thing that you learned that you would go back to and do differently, or are doing differently now, or would do differently in a new book? Any of these?
Oh, okay. So with each of my books, I have specific goals that I want to focus on. Mark of the Critic, I mentioned first person. I wanted to write in first person. I wanted to write a male MC, so both are new things. My third goal was that I wanted to write an action-oriented novel. I completely failed at that. And that's why The Root of All Evil continued that goal. So I had Root of All Evil. I wanted to do an action, fast-paced novel. I wanted to have a proper, you know, crafting system, skill-focused with various abilities, and I wanted to have a fully fleshed-out main character. With my next series, I've got a new set of goals. So first of all, I want a compelling villain. In my next series, one that can grow alongside the main character, provide a challenge among the other villains as well that appear. So that's one driver. The other driver is that I wanted to have a character that hasn't been reincarnated, because I haven't done that before. And the third one is that I want to have a system that impacts directly onto the character in a tangible way, because I found that my stats kind of go up, but it's hard to tell the visible effect of what they do for the character, right?
Yeah, that's hard to do, actually, because you held up Ben Curry's reincarnated as a farmer. And I think he's one of the only ones that really does that and brings it to a logical conclusion.
Well, right? That's the thing. So, wait, let me just check. One second. All right. I've got Iron Prince here, just resting right beside me. Yeah, I think Iron Prince does incredibly well with the system. So people don't usually refer to Iron Prince as Lit RPG, so I was surprised when I read it that it was Lit RPG. Kind of like Lit RPG Lite, but Lit RPG still. It's the whole driving... it's not cultivation so much. So what happens is he's got his cheat ability is that he has an S-ranked growth stat. So he is the fastest growing, weakest person, but fastest growing in terms of his strength, proportional to his original base. That's the thing. That entire ability, that entire system drives the entire plot, if that makes sense. There's a tangible result, not only of having that skill, but then the effect it has on the main character, who gains upgrades as the skills progress, right? And they're visible upgrades. He gains, I think it was claws and boots by the end of the first novel, right? Doing some serious damage. That's the kind of system abilities and stats that I want. Ones that affect the story, both plot-wise and in terms of power. Now, Mark of the Critic, absolutely brilliant for the Mark of the Critic itself affecting the plot. But even though it's a skill ability, it's also a physical, tangible object inside him, an actual mark. And so it's not quite what I wanted, right? Mm-hmm. And the Root of All Evil, the Root of All Evil, that has tangible effects that are visible, but not really for the plot line itself. So it's all about how he can craft different symbols. He can then go and do different elemental effects based on these symbols, right? Because he's got his own abilities. That's great. It's a lot of different skills. It's a lot of different elements, a lot of different abilities of different types that can be utilized in different ways. It's his own personal power progression, but they have no effect on the plot. I would like an ability that has an effect both on the plot and on the personal power levels.
Try and look if there's anyone here that does the same sort of thing. That one.
So I also have Hedge Wizard. Yay! So Hedge Wizard is a good one for that as well, because the main character's magic, well, it ends up becoming a plot driver by the end of the book one. Like the end of book one, but pretty much from the beginning. Like the fact that he is a Hedge Wizard, the fact that he... So you find out very quickly that he inherits his late master's position, right? Sort of like a class. And that's exactly what drives the plot in various ways, but also empowers the main character. So those two novels, Iron Prince and Hedge Wizard, do exactly what I want to do with my third novel or third series very well.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, third series, does it mean that you're ready to finish either of them?
So Mark of the Krijic was meant to be about 8 to 10 books. And when the fifth book turned out to be 215,000 words, because I was trying to make it plot driven, I realized it will probably be 7 books, but the rest are all going to be the size of 2 books because they're normally 110,000 words long. So it'll be 7 books or so. The Root of All Evil is a tough one to answer. That one keeps growing. So I had the second book all planned out. The Tournament of Kings. It was going to be all about the Tournament of Kings, as named. The first arc was going to be him exploring an underwater temple. The first act was meant to be him. And now that's 150,000 words in, and he's just entered the temple. Yay! Because a lot of plot stuff. Like, it's still incredibly plot-driven, but it could end up being 3 books. It could end up being 6 books. I'm not quite sure yet. It just depends how the plot flows. But it won't be more than 6 books, unless it's 7. But it won't be more than 7.
I definitely know the feeling of stuff ballooning out of control. Like, that's real. Yeah, very relatable. Okay. You held up a lot of books. You have a lot of printed books. You have more printed lit RPG books than most people I know. They all read on Kindle. So what's one book... In general, doesn't have to be lit RPG. Sorry, again. In general, doesn't have to be lit RPG. That you love, and why is it awesome?
Okay, so there's two... Well, there's a lot of answers for this. I really liked Iron Prince and Hedge Wizard for different reasons. Mark of the Krijic is my favorite book to reread. Like, I love reading my own writing. It's nice. Because you forget about the sentences, you kind of look back and you think, did I really write this sentence? And then you're like, wait, I did. That's so cool. But I suppose if I was
like,
to pick...
There's two kinds of writers. Ones who read their own sentences and are like, yeah, it's kind of cool. And others who go like, what the fuck did I just write?
Well, I'm trying to find the books here. Okay, so I've got it all in the other bookcase, so I can't get them all. So this is Arcane Ascension, Book 4, The Silence of Unworthy Gods. But I actually liked Book 1, but there's a caveat there. I absolutely love the first 2 pages. I think they're the perfect 2 pages in all of, like, lit RPG and progression fantasy of Book 1 of Arcane Ascension. Because they set, in the first few paragraphs, they set the stakes, they set the goal, they set the setting as well as the progression power system in play, and the main character's personality. All of that in the first 2 pages. I was astounded. I think I've talked, so I don't know if you know Nekarin and Juggernaut, so the authors of Mark of the Fool and Unbound. So I talked with them and a few other people as well on a server just saying, wow, you guys have got to read these first 2 pages because they are insane. Like, just so amazing. The rest of the book was really good too. Like, obviously I read the whole series, but those 2 pages were good. Where did I put it? I think if we go from my favorite book, one that had a lot of influence on my story, it's Beware of Chicken. So Beware of Chicken, it influenced the magic system. So my magic system in Mark of the Krijic it's a soft magic system for the most part. So one where you get a feel for the magic and then you can weave the magic and become one with it, you know, be friends with the actual different elements, those sorts of things, and the different types of mana. It's a different path of progression. Beware of Chicken, I'm absolutely love this chapter. I think it's chapter 30, I can't remember off the top of my head, where the disciple, the girl, is talking to the main character, who she still thinks is ordinary, but she pushes past the barrier of what she sees, and she sees everything connected by ki. I love that chapter. That influenced my own chapter 30. I think so. I can't remember if Beware of Chickens was chapter 30 as well, but mine was chapter 30 for sure. That whole chapter was my favorite chapter to write and all of it was influenced by the feeling I got from Beware of Chicken when I was reading it all the way back then. But if we're talking about overall books that I most like, that I really liked, then so that one I liked specific chapter. With Arcane Ascension, I loved the first two pages. The one I liked the whole book around, and this was ages ago that I read it, Azarinth Healer. So Azarinth Healer is one of the fathers, or mothers, depending on how you look at it, of Lit RPG. I don't have a physical copy of it, but the other one that inspired me, and it inspired so many people, probably birthed the genre in its own way, is The Legendary Moonlight Sculptor. So I don't know if you know that series. Here you do.
Well, I mean, Royal Road used to be
Royal Road, yeah.
The Moonlight Sculptor fan page. So
yeah,
I
and
do
so,
know of it, but I haven't read it.
Yeah, and so I've got a long history with that novel too. I used to be one of the admins on the original Blogspot that then spun off and became became Royal Road. So it was actually still called Royal Road back then. They just made it into a website afterwards. And I was in the first 250 users, not quite sure which one, but I was in the first of them for Royal Road as well. So that was fun. Yeah, good nice. Times. And that was all because of Legendary Moonlight Sculptor, which in turn inspired me to keep reading Lit RPG and inspired me eventually to write them as well. I think my first story is 9 years going on 10 now for Royal Road in terms of when I posted it. Yeah.
Yeah. I still haven't read it. I might.
I well, my first story. I don't.
No, no. Yes, but also Moonlight Sculptor.
Oh, see, I think it's a bit outdated now with all the changes. Yeah. But it has some of the best. Just, it's a staple that people might not know. Like, they might think it's cliche now, but back then, all the things were revolutionary in there that later became commonplace in every other novel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. One book that you love, and why is it awesome? And you told me like five. Which is good. No, it's good.
Yeah.
I like it. And, well, actually, considering that we were like way over the 1 hour mark already. So, shout outs.
Sure. Well, I've already said quite a few offers here. Let's see. Oh, I know. A novel that I did enjoy a lot as well that I shout out didn't exactly like influence my work or anything like that, but. It was good. So, Into the Labyrinth. So, John Bierce's Major Rant series is nice. This one I'll shout out with the caveat that I didn't go past book two for the series, but I thought book one was amazing, and I think people should kind of stop after book one. In a good way. It's more like, yeah, so it continued off into a direction that I wasn't quite, you know, there wasn't quite me at the time for wanting to read. But book one, I thought all round was just amazing in every way. And if I'd been in the mood to read the rest of the series, that would have been how I continued it. It's this one, The Choice of Magic.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, that was a good one. I just wasn't in the mood to read past book two at the time. Like, it was just, you know, when you get those moods where you're like, I want to read a certain type of book, just not this type of book kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So those ones are good. And again, Sufficiently Advanced Magic and Azarinth Healer and stuff, all amazing. Oh, and The Chosen One by Tevaga. That's a good trilogy as well.
Yeah, I already had John Bierce on the podcast. That was nice. He was really, really good.
Cool. I saw that actually. Yeah.
Cool. Nice. Yeah. Have you watched any of them? Any of them?
I did. Yes. I watched the one. I'm bad with names. So you did a podcast with a narrator recently, and she was talking with you about, I believe, ADHD and different things, as well as how she doesn't read other books while she's narrating a certain book because the voices will bleed in to her narration from that other book if she, you know, reads it at the same time. Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I resonated with that. So the reason I have so many physical books, as you might have noticed, is because if I read them online, I bleed that voice into my work. And that's why I buy the physical copies, because I couldn't do audiobooks. It's just not my kind of thing. And so I tried it. I tried a physical copy of one of them, The Chosen One by Tevegar. And then I tried another physical copy of Sufficiently Advanced Magic. And I realized I could read them and fully enjoy them and not have any issues at all with the characters bleeding into my own work. So, cool.
Audiobooks help for me with that? But as a saying, like, it doesn't work for everyone. Audiobooks may be distracting to some. But I can only listen to audiobooks while I'm walking. I can't listen to them like on the couch or anything. I have to have something to do while I'm doing it. Otherwise, my focus just bleeds, goes away.
Yep.
But yeah, I very much respect having your own thing that then allows you to keep your own voice going. How much do you read? Besides writing,
that's a tough one. I read a lot, so I've always read a lot, but that's not necessarily in the medium of text. So I read a lot of manga. I read a lot of web novels. I read a lot of physical novels too, and they kind of all merge together. I can't say how much I read. So I've read a few chapters of a manga today. I've read a few chapters of a book today. If I'm really concentrating, I can get through one book a day at generally 250,000 words or so. And that's not too abnormal or anything like that. When it comes to manga, it's a lot more. I think I sort of get like the picture medium is a lot quicker for me, probably for a lot of people. And so I go through a lot more than, you know, a lot more books or volumes in a quick amount of time.
I'm asking because so many authors I talk to say they just don't have the time to read anymore. Because, I mean, sometimes for me too, I read something and then my editor brain goes on.
Yes.
And I'm thinking, like, oh man, I would have done this differently, or I would have done that differently, and I can't really enjoy it anymore. And also, it's just not fair to the author, and I don't like to think badly of people.
I get that too, a lot. That's why I have the physical books. As I mentioned, it helps me turn off from the editing sort of and style copying sort of things that happen if you read them and they subconsciously, you know, affect you. But more importantly, that's why the manga's there. The manga, correct myself. I don't go into editing mode or author mode or anything when I'm reading it. And so if I need to, I just read that the entire day instead of a physical book or a web novel, anything like that. Unless it's super supportive. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Unless it's super supportive. Super supportive would make such a good comic. But
yeah.
that's why I have the Kindle. The Kindle really helps. I have kind of like Kindle Paperwhite. And that really helps me. Helps me out a lot, even though it's all in black and white, and sometimes it's laggy, and I'm like, ah, god damn it.
I could maybe do the Kindle. As I mentioned, I've got some physical limitations, so I don't hold the phone for long periods of time when I'm looking at it. That's what I usually use instead of a laptop or anything. Laptop's just for work. With a Kindle, it's really big, so if I'm sitting on the couch, I can't actually hold it. I would have to find a new method of like, I don't know, putting a stand there.
There's this really cool telescopic arms. Like $10.
That'd be cool. I'll look into it.
I have one of those for bed because I screwed my back up a little bit by doing all the yoga poses with books. Like, now do the reverse crawl and arch your back backwards to read thing. Like, it's not good. But yeah. The arms help. They're really good.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. So you can be... oh my God. If I put my alarm clock to it, it would be an alarm. Huh. Wow. Anyway,
smack you in the face with a robotic arm, you know,
this German inventor who like invented useless robots to just like slap you in the face or put too much ketchup on your sausage or whatever. Like,
Hey, that's funny. Actually, I We just received news. Mark of the Critics getting a German translation. So that's, I've gotten the release dates. They'll be a year from now in February 25th or so. So that's fun.
But it will be exactly at that time, yes? who are you publishing with?
So I'm published with Aethon, but the actual German translations are published by someone else. Aethon? Okay, I always get that.
Yeah. Everyone says Aethon, but there's no second E there. but you can the mnemonic is it's Aethon of Fun. So yeah, there you go.
Yes.
But I know some German publishers, and I was gonna ask you which one it was, but
I can check. It's Siegel der Kritik or something like that.
Siegel des Kritik, yeah.
Yeah. There we go. Okay, cool. I've got it up. I cannot read German, so don't mind me if I butcher this. Zweihänder Publishing.
Oh, actually, that's Dimi. That's a friend of mine.
Oh, is it? Cool.
Yeah. Pretty cool. Nice. Good for him. Yeah. So we're hanging out every once in a while. Like, he lives close to me. It's really nice.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So if he doesn't do well by you, just tell me, I'll punch him. It's fine.
Will do.
Okay. But on that slightly threatening note, hi, Dimi, by the way, because he's going to listen to this podcast. I won't punch you. You're way, way stronger than me, and I'm kind of afraid of you. So please don't hurt me. On that slightly threatening note, this has been a Crit RPG podcast. Thank you so much for listening and watching. And please do leave a follow, like, subscribe. You know the drill. Actually, you know, YouTubers always say, oh, hey, like, it helps me out so much. Do you know why they say that? Think twice.
Why?
Because it actually helps them out. No, because there's certain thresholds for followers that you have to hit in order to unlock certain YouTube algorithm things. And really? Then also there is the algorithm itself. And the more you like, the more you comment, the more you engage with the video in any way, shape, or form, the more it's being shown to other people. So if you want to inflict me on more people, do leave a like, a comment, and all that kind of stuff.
Hey, maybe okay. I'll start my own.
Yeah, do it. Okay. I dare you. Do it. So this has been the Crit RPG podcast. Again, thank you so much for listening and watching. With me today has been Think Twice. Say goodbye to Think Twice. And I'll see you next time.